Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Gerard Anderson, Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Hospital Finance. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a new tool for the early diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's every working parent's nagging fear. What happens if your child comes down with an illness while you're at work and they're at daycare? A pilot program in Rochester, New York, offers a glimpse into what could be a promising solution, telemedicine. The federally funded grant between the University of Rochester Medical Center and several urban daycare centers equipped the daycare centers with diagnostic peripherals that could be attached to their cell phones and images sent to the pediatric clinic via the internet. Usually when a child exhibits signs of a sore throat, ear infection, or pink eye, the parents are immediately called, meaning the parents have to leave work and the child taken to a doctor's office. These daycare workers still call the parent, but the next call is to the doctor's office for a live visit via teleconferencing.
Our telemedicine program is designed to make it easy for your child to be seen for an illness by one of our regular doctors. Most common problems can be cared for this way.
Daycare workers are trained to utilize diagnostic tools like the otoscope, the tool used to examine the ears. The image is transmitted to the clinician via the internet and a diagnosis is made. In many cases, the telemedicine visit was sufficient for a clinician to diagnose a child's problem and recommending a treatment course. The statistics are also compelling. Working parents were able to retain 4.5 hours of working time, and the children's absenteeism was reduced by 63%. The pilot program has been so successful that local insurance companies are now getting on board with covering these telemedicine visits. It's simple economics. A trip to the emergency room costs insurance companies a lot more than a teleconference visit, and parents have peace of mind that their child's health needs are being adequately addressed. The program is already being rolled out in other daycare centers in the region and could provide an excellent model for daycare centers around the country. A safe, simple telemedicine solution to a logistics problem facing millions of working parents whose kids fall ill while at daycare. Now that's a bright idea. We're speaking today with economist Dr. Gerard Anderson, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Hospital Finance. Dr. Anderson is a professor at the Bloomberg School of Public Health and the School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University, where he has served for almost 30 years. Dr. Anderson has conducted extensive research on healthcare payment reform and recently stepped down as national program director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation program on living better with chronic disease. He has conducted an in-depth study of health systems around the world for World Bank and USAID. He has authored 2 books on healthcare payment policy, and he has written over 200 peer-reviewed articles. Dr. Anderson, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, I'm pleased to be here and part of this conversation.
Dr. Anderson, as a health economist, you've spent a considerable part of your career analyzing healthcare spending and cost. Now that the Affordable Care Act has been upheld, we should see some meaningful reforms in place that could ultimately impact the cost of care delivery in this country. Let's start by putting healthcare spending into perspective. How does healthcare spending here stack up with that of other countries, and how are we doing in terms of value that we receive for our healthcare spending?
So we're spending about twice as much as most other industrialized countries. So we spend about $8,500 a year per person in the United States. Countries like Japan, France, England spend less than $4,000. So we're spending twice as much as they are. Now, I don't mind spending twice as much on something if I'm getting twice as much value from it. twice as good outcomes. The problem is there are certain areas where the United States does incredibly well. There are also, unfortunately, certain areas where the United States does very poorly. And overall, we sort of do about average, a little less than average in most of our healthcare indicators, things like life expectancy. So in that regard, we're spending twice as much and getting sort of average. We're just not doing very well on the value equation these days.
Dr. Anderson, I think that hospital financing is a fairly mysterious area. We look at, you know, Medicare and ambulatory care or outpatient care. It's kind of pretty well defined. You know, there's a board that sets prices. What one will be paid by Medicare is pretty well established. Some geographic variation. We see so much more variation in hospital pricing. You've used the example of five patients, five different hospitals having the same gallbladder surgery might have wildly different fees. Tell us a little bit about what drives this great variation in pricing. How is that likely to change, if at all, under healthcare reform?
Hospitals represent about 35% of our healthcare spending. And the thing is that for the Medicare program, the program for the elderly and the disabled, there's a very nice formula. And Medicare basically pays hospitals their costs. The private sector, basically, Aetna, Prudential, all the other private insurers, they pay anything that they want. There is no standard for that, so in one insurer might pay twice as much as another insurer, and it's particularly bad if you're uninsured. Then you have nobody negotiating on your behalf, and in that case, you're going to pay 3 to 5 times what somebody with insurance is going to pay for exactly the same thing. And so as we move towards the Affordable Care Act and getting a lot of people into health insurance, those people are going to pay a lot less for exactly the same services they had, because now 30 million Americans will have health insurance.
So is that the only incentive built into the Affordable Care Act to address the issue of reducing cost, which is just purchasing power? Are there other incentives built in to help realign the payment structure?
Well, there are, but the first thing for the public to understand is the Affordable Care Act really wasn't intended as a cost containment activity. Its real intention was to get the 30 million Americans health insurance, and to pay for it, it needed to have some cost containment activities. But the real goal of the Affordable Care Act was really to cover 30 million additional people. So they essentially made some deals with the pharmaceutical industry. So if you're an elderly person and use a lot of drugs, you're going to get a substantial discount on your drug as a result of the Affordable Care Act. If you are an elderly person and you need preventive services, you're now going to get them free, and that's going to save you a great deal of money. We all know that if you're have a child who's under 26, they're going to get services for free. There's something called IPAB, which is a way for the government to negotiate if industry is charging too much. And finally, what we see is right now private insurers are taking a lot of cost in terms of administrative costs, and what the government is doing as part of the Affordable Care Act is really clamping down on how much administrative costs private insurers can do. So yes, there's a number of things in the legislation that are going to save money, but it's important to recognize that that wasn't the primary purpose of the Affordable Care Act.
Maybe we could look a little bit at what is the role of hospitals and the acute care setting. And we see a shift from people who are uninsured and requiring uncompensated care because, as you note, the uninsured person might be charged 5 times the amount of the insured person for that gallbladder surgery, but it's not likely they have the money to pay it. If they had the money to pay it, they'd probably be insured in the first place, right? So one could at least hypothesize that hospitals will see a great reduction in the number of uninsured people who rely on charity care or uncompensated care, and that might free up resources for investments in other areas. How do you see this really affecting hospital finances, and how are all of you in the hospital financing and future planning world looking at that?
Well, I think you're correct that they are going to see a lot more people that are going to walk into the hospital with an insurance card, and that means that all of us don't have to pay those charges for somebody who's uninsured. because essentially when somebody goes to the hospital doesn't have insurance, they still get care. They still get the same level of care that anybody else does, and it's expensive. And what it means is that we all who have insurance have been paying those bills. Now, the Medicare and Medicaid program have had some adjustments called disproportionate share, which essentially allow the federal government to pay a little bit of the uncompensated care cost, and some of that will go away. But really, the big difference that we'll see is for a person who has private health insurance, who's been paying the bulk of the cost of the uninsured, their premiums are, in fact, going to go down because they're not any longer going to have to pay the cost of the uninsured. So all of us who do have health insurance, about 170 million of us through the private insurance system, we're going to see a substantial reduction in the price when we go to a hospital. And I think that's just going to be very good for all of us.
We're speaking today with Dr. Gerard Anderson, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Hospital Finance. Dr. Anderson is a professor at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, as well as the School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins. He's conducted extensive research on healthcare payment reform and recently stepped down as the national program director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation program on living better with chronic disease. You know, I want to go back to the Affordable Care Act because one of the provisions in there is around accountable care organizations. And the Department of Health and Human Services recently announced that there are now more than 150 accountable care organizations. And these physician groups and hospitals are forming ACOs to streamline process, share costs, primarily for the Medicare population. How do you see these ACOs impacting the bottom line cost in healthcare across the board? And are ACOs poised to change the game significantly?
Well, I think they're poised to do it. So what we have now is a lot of people in managed care. And managed care is an insurance system. And what the doctors and hospitals have told us for years is if we could manage this care more effectively and really had control of it, we could, in fact, save a lot of money because we know that we're doing a lot of things that are unnecessary. We know that a lot of things just could change. And so the accountable care organizations are putting the control in the hands of doctors and hospitals instead of the hands of the insurance industry. And so there's a great potential here with the accountable care organizations. Now, the challenge has been that they still don't really have any incentives to control costs the way the accountable care organizations have been established. They really don't take very much risk, and when they do take risk, they don't get very many savings. So I'm not sure that it's going to really save a great deal of money, but it's going to start transforming the healthcare system. We've also taken a look at things like accountable care organizations over the past 10 years, and so far we just haven't seen the savings.
Well, Dr. Anderson, I'm still holding on to that idea that we're going to see our premiums go down as we go into this new era, and hopefully we'll see some savings there, at least to consumers. But let me ask you to put your futurist hat on again for a moment. Really talk about the future of hospitals and the hospital industry. Do you see fewer hospitals? Do you see the community general hospitals continuing in the large numbers they are today? What about the boutique hospitals that have sprung up? There's a lot going on, I would imagine, in the industry. And share your thoughts on that with us.
So I think what the hospitals are going to have to do is start thinking about population-based medicine. Hospitals are really based upon acute care model, which is a fine model, but really a model for the 1970s and 1980s, where, you know, we wait until we get sick and then we get treatment. And the population model that's really coming in the 21st century is about care. We're keeping people out of the hospital. So the hospital industry has to be prepared for a lot less volume. We've seen it decline over the last 30 years. We used to have 6,000 hospitals. Now we have 5,000 hospitals, and that number will continue to drop. We'll still need academic medical centers, and we'll still need hospitals, but we're going to need, hopefully, fewer and fewer hospitals in the United States over time.
Well, Margaret asked you to put your futurist hat on. I'm going to ask you to put your anthropological hat on. And it's sort of been an interesting civic lesson watching this whole health care reform debate unfold. There is so much acrimony and there are so many diverse points of view. The debate on health care reform has been polarized and divided. Since you have compared systems around the world that provide health care to entire populations of countries, how is it that the benefit of improving our current health care system, making it more inclusive, more efficient, effective, elegant, less expensive, has been lost on the country as a whole?
Well, if you look at other countries, one of the things that they have going for them is solidarity. Everybody sort of buys into the same model and the fact that everybody's in it for the greater good. In the United States, we're sort of more based upon an individualism, you know, the individual taking charge of their own health care.
So, Dr. Anderson, I'm really intrigued by the work that you've done looking at really the epicenter of both the challenges and the opportunities, and that's looking at chronic disease in this country. And I know you've just stepped down recently as the National Program Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Program, Partnership for Solutions, Better Lives for People with Chronic Conditions. You note that 65 cents of every healthcare dollar is spent on treating chronic diseases and that a better system has to be put in place. Tell us about the four-part framework that you and your group devised to try and tackle this area.
So chronic disease is the problem, at least the first half of the 21st century. It's where the healthcare dollar is spent. And it really isn't just chronic disease, but it's people with multiple chronic diseases, two, three, four. If you think of your mother, your grandmother, there's unfortunately a number of things wrong with many of the people. They have high blood pressure, they have diabetes, they might have beginning dementia. And that's just a fairly common thing in the United States right now. The problem is that we've got a healthcare system oriented around acute illness, not chronic disease. And it starts with our research, what the NIH does and what the FDA does. And that is, anybody who has a multiple chronic condition is almost always excluded from any clinical trial. So we just don't have an evidence base for taking care of the complex person. Then you move towards the educational system, and I teach at Johns Hopkins, and we do a great job of treating you and training you body part by body part. But we don't really train you to take care of the whole person. Then we've got to change our educational system. The payment system is for an episode of care, a particular service that's being delivered. That's called the fee-for-service system, and it just doesn't provide any incentives for prevention. It doesn't provide any incentives to look at the person over a long period of time or to look at all the different problems they have. So the payment system has to change.
Dr. Anderson, the Affordable Care Act has survived its many legal challenges, and health reform is moving forward. And you've said it's a step in the right direction. You certainly underscored the issue that it's focused in on access, but obviously you're have written in the past about your ideas of what should be in place. Walk us through the missing elements of the healthcare law and what should be done there.
Well, the first thing is we've covered 30 million Americans, but probably about 20 million Americans still won't have health insurance coverage. And these are people who are undocumented, who for whatever reason choose not to purchase health insurance. So sooner or later, we've got to get these 20 million Americans into the healthcare system. You mentioned Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D is Medicare for everyone, and it essentially is not the public option, but it's a variant of the public option, which says that if you want to, you can buy into the Medicare program at reasonable premium rates. And you would essentially have an option of not going to Blue Cross or to Aetna, but essentially getting the same coverage with the same benefits as a Medicare beneficiary. And, you know, it's just a system that is all set up. We could certainly add 20, 30 million people to the Medicare rolls at a small administrative cost. The Medicare program only costs about 3 cents in administrative fees. Most of the private insurers are about 20 cents, $0.25 in administrative fees. So you'd get a lot more value for your dollar if you could buy into the Medicare program. And that's just a way to do it more effectively and to provide coverage for a large number of people.
Well, I think there would have been a lot of support for that in many quarters. So, Dr. Anderson, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
Think of an older woman with dementia who falls. She is going to have a very difficult problem. And so the question that we're really struggling with right now is how to meld all the different services that she's going to need, both the medical services, maybe some behavioral health because of her dementia, maybe some long-term care services, some transportation problems that she's got. All the countries in the world are really trying to struggle with that particular type of person who has multiple needs. And right now, all the different systems are set up to work in silos. The silos work reasonably well, but the person has to deal with 6 or 7 different silos, all of which are not coordinated. And until we get the financing and the delivery systems in place, she's going to have to do all the coordination, or her family member is going to have to do all the coordination themselves. And that's what I'm hoping in the next 10 years we'll be able to make it much, much better.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Gerard Anderson, Director of Hospital Finance and Management at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm Mariano here with this tech report. Parkinson's disease affects about 21 million people around the world, and diagnosis only occurs through a targeted clinical analysis, often after insidious symptoms have been present for a while. There are no known biomarkers for the disease, but nearly all Parkinson's patients experience some form of vocal impairment in early stages of the disease. MIT visiting fellow Dr. Max Little had a good idea. As a scientist who's created voice analysis algorithms, Little figured he could program a computer to recognize voice variances typically found in Parkinson's patients. And since telephones are ubiquitous throughout the world, he figured it would be a perfect tool for gathering data and scaling up the research.
So, this raises a very interesting possibility. If we could use the entire existing telephone network, then we could scale up the screening of Parkinson's disease to the entire population and do it at very minimal cost.
Dr. Little in a recent promotional video. In his first formal test of the algorithm, study subjects were asked to hold one sound frequency for as long as possible, analyzing several simple sounds. The algorithm successfully identified the Parkinson's patients with 99% accuracy. The Parkinson's Voice Initiative has phone data banks set up in 7 countries, including the U.S. Healthy subjects, as well as those who may suspect they have an issue, can anonymously call in and lend their voice to the ongoing study. Little hopes to perfect his algorithm even further, eventually making the program available to Intel's at-home testing device, a telemonitoring system that could link those being screened directly with a clinician for early diagnosis. An inexpensive diagnostic tool that has the potential to scan entire populations for Parkinson's at a minimal cost. I'm Mariano here with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of connecting our communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.